Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here with another installment of Christogenos with my co-host here, Pastor William Fink. We're going to be continuing on our series on the book of Daniel. And last time we left off at Daniel chapter 7, verse 21. But before we get started, Bill, do you have you want to bring us back up to speed here? What we had covered in this chapter already.
Well, basically, the first part of Daniel's vision in Daniel chapter 7 is that same vision that he had in chapter 2, but here it's expressed a little differently. And
right.
It's four beasts, which represent the series of empires that actually ruled over the known world, or most of it, for 1,260 years,
right.
or thereabouts.
Yes, okay. And then the first one was Babylon, then Medo-Persia, then Greece, and then Rome. These are the four empires. And in chapter 7, they're referred to as beasts. And in chapter 2, they're referred to as part of the image of,
right.
of the man.
And,
you know.
And we actually compared the similarities of the four beast vision of Daniel to the first beast of Revelation chapter 13.
Right, right.
Which
right.
is basically talking about the same thing.
Yes, yes.
And now we started to discuss the second beast of Revelation chapter 13 in conjunction with the little horn of Daniel chapter 7. And they're both talking, I believe, about the same thing.
Right. Okay, well, let me just back up here. We've identified the four beasts, and we're talking about the kingdom of Rome. And, of course, we ultimately will make a distinction between imperial Rome and papal Rome, because those are the two phases of the Roman Empire that were divided by the deadly wound, okay? And the wound was healed, and the papacy resulted. Let me just back up here to verse 20 of Daniel chapter 7. And of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. And then who are we talking about here? Where the 10 horns are talking about these 10 Roman provinces?
Well, you know, it seems to be, however, you know, in 724, it says the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise.
Okay.
And another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first. And he shall subdue three kings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that in the horns of 7-7 and 7-20 seem to indicate 10 kingdoms.
Yes.
Whereas here in 7-24, it's talking about 10 kings from this kingdom.
Okay.
And that definitely identifies Justinian.
Okay.
Justinian was actually at the 11th Eastern, the 11th emperor of the Eastern Empire.
Okay.
Oh, okay, and I can name the first 10.
I see. Okay.
From Valens in 364 up to and the one before Justinian, Justin in 518. Justinian was definitely the 11th.
So we're talking about Byzantium, the Eastern Kingdom.
Yes.
And Justinian would be number 11.
Right. So we have 10 horns. I know the horns in other places reference kingdoms.
Okay.
But here in 724 it definitely says 10 king.
Yes, okay. There are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first. And the first would have been Constantine, right?
The first emperor, the first, Constantine was not the first emperor of a divided Roman empire.
Right.
The first one was Valens in 364.
Okay,
was the first official Eastern Roman emperor who did not have rule over the West.
Oh, okay. So Constantine simply moved headquarters from Rome.
Basically.
Yeah. Okay.
And he had competition in diverse parts of the empire that he put down eventually.
Right.
But
right.
he did not rule from Rome.
Okay.
He ruled from Byzantium.
Right. Okay. So let me back up to verse 21. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints Okay, now usually this is considered to be the papacy, made war with the saints and prevailed against the horn, that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke very great things. We're back in Daniel 7, 20 and 21 here. And prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Okay, aren't we talking here about the development of, you know, the Christian Israelite world that ultimately overthrew papal Rome? Is that how you see?
Well, absolutely.
Okay.
And you know, all the commentators try to identify this 11th horn as who subdued three kings, and they look for three kingdoms.
Right.
And they say the Goths and North Africa, but it didn't say he subdued three kingdoms. It says he subdues three kings.
Yeah.
And Procopius, if you read, Procopius was the historian of the wars of Justinian.
Okay.
And he wrote an entire history of all the wars of Justinian, and he had firsthand knowledge of them.
Okay.
And he actually describes four wars of Justinian, two separate Gothic kings, the king of the Vandals and the Persians.
Uh-huh.
All right, but Justinian never really defeats the Persians.
I see.
Yeah, you know, they're always fighting to a stalemate or getting beat back and forth, but he never really succeeds in Persia.
Yeah,
but
okay.
He does defeat Gelimer, the Vandal king at Carthage, Vitiges, the king of the Ostrogoths, and another great Gothic king, Totila.
Okay.
And they're the three kings that he defeats.
Okay.
And that's that prophecy is actually filled to a T. Now, Justinian, changing times and laws.
Yeah.
All right?
Okay.
First, Justinian established the supremacy of the Bishop of Rome over the rest of the Christianity within the empire.
Okay.
Second, Justinian established the temporal, meaning the worldly, power of the papacy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And third, Justinian recodified Roman law into the new constitutions, Justinian's novels, they're called, the Novellae Constitutions.
Okay.
And he recodified all of Roman law, and European law to this day is in great part founded upon that.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and they want to reestablish it. Yeah, because it has indeed been secular Roman law in Europe. Yeah, and it's still there. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Justinian actually, the things that he did, I mean, he wasn't the Pope himself.
Right.
But the papacy, which he created,
mm-hmm.
Which he was, I mean, the Roman bishops from the days of Eusebius were trying to assert hegemony over the other bishops.
Right. Right.
But under Justinian, they achieved it.
Okay.
And the other Christian bishops in the days of Eusebius would have no part of it. They
right.
were like, get out of here.
You know, all the major cities of the Christian world had their own bishops.
And they were absolutely autonomous.
Right. Autonomous, had nothing to do with Rome, and Rome had no authority over them whatsoever.
Right.
Yeah.
And this says, you know, until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and in a way, you know, this little horn, this papal system is still to this day making war with the saints.
That's right.
Even though he's lost his dominion,
mm-hmm.
he's still making war with the saints.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I interpret it as once the Catholic Church lost its ranking as the sixth beast, the second half of the sixth beast, to Napoleon, he did obviously not destroy the Catholic Church. He just kind of wounded it again.
Yeah, right. Well, it's, you know, it's fallen from dominion, but it still
right.
makes war with us. There's
no
doubt.
Absolutely right. It's absolutely. It's a false prophet now.
Yeah,
the false
oh, yeah.
prophet doesn't do anything good.
Absolutely. There are many other prophecies in play.
Yes.
But, yeah, the church, even though it's lost its dominion, it still works much evil against us.
Yeah, well, it's
in the name of, like, just for instance, all of the Marxism in South America and in this country and in Mexico, it is much of it's instituted and taught to the people through the Catholic Church.
Right, the Jesuits especially. The Jesuit nuns and priests in the 60s were instrumental in spreading Marxism in Central America.
The Catholic Church is also one of the leading movers and shakers behind the open borders and the amnesty for illegal aliens cause.
Right, and they provide sanctuary. We've had several local scandals here in Chicago where Catholic churches are giving sanctuary to illegal aliens.
So they're still making war with the saints.
That's right.
Even
that's
though they lost their dominion.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's played out just basically just the way prophecy says it's going to.
Yeah, and the false prophet does not get thrown into the lake of fire until the very end, until the
right.
judgment day. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so the false prophet vis-a-vis the papacy is still with us. You know, and I generalize it too to ecumenism, that is, and the Catholic Church is the major proponent of ecumenism, which is the attempt to merge all of the world's religions into one, despite the fact that they have differing doctrines, you know, and so they want to get all the different religions back together and hopefully be the most important bishop over all the churches, okay. And that's what the Catholic Church is trying to do. They're trying to reestablish their dictatorship over the other churches. Okay?
Well, right. And you know, a lot of people think that – a lot of these futurists think that Rome is going to rule again. But it's very clear in Daniel chapter 2 that the four beasts were given up to the four winds of heaven and that all of these kingdoms were made like chaff.
Right.
And you can't put chaff back together again.
Right.
And the Catholic Church is reduced to being an arm of the beast, but it's never going to have world hegemony again.
No.
It can't.
There's no way they can take over from the Jews.
From the Rothschilds.
From the Rothschilds, exactly.
So how far did you read here? Because I have a lot of comments yet, and I'd like to do a comparison of this to Revelation 13, 9 through 18.
Okay, well, here, let me finish reading 23, and I'll read 24 again. And is that where you want to talk about the Revelation 13?
Well, you could go all the way through 28.
28? Okay, well, let me just read to the end then. So verse 23, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms and shall devour the whole earth. Of course, we're talking about the Roman Empire here. And shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And the ten horns out of this kingdom are the ten kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings. We just discussed that in terms of Justinian and the ten kings that preceded him. So he was the 11th, verse 25. And he shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints. We're definitely talking about papal Rome here. And as you just said, Justinian was instrumental in establishing the papacy. And one
absolutely,
of things,
and they did nothing but wear out the saints.
That's right, that's right. The beheadings and the stretchings, putting
well,
them on the rack, dunking,
war,
you name it, torture.
The 30 years war and the crusades, which were only to satiate the greed of the popes.
Right.
You know, I mean, how many millions of Europeans died going off to fight the Moors?
Right. Exactly.
To fight the Arabs. But,
yeah.
And Yahweh said that Israel could never go back there, true Israel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he drew a hedge.
Yes.
Between the ten so-called lost tribes and Palestine.
Where did he say that? Because I know that Yahshua cursed Jerusalem. And
well, that too, but
yes.
I would have to.
And it's in Jeremiah, I believe.
It's either in Jeremiah or
Isaiah.
Isaiah.
But if you don't mind looking for that while I read the rest of this, verse 25, and he shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High. This is definitely the papacy, folks. Oh, yeah, and Justinian established the monastery system, which was, you know, contributed greatly to the Catholic Church taking away property from the Christian world, from Europeans, and assuming control over all that profit. Property, and of course they established the indulgences, and the Dark Ages ensued as a result of all that. And think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time. Okay, so while if you're still looking, I can comment on this.
Well, I have it in Hosea 2:6 actually.
Oh, okay, all right.
Therefore, behold, I will hedge the way up with thorns and make a wall that she shall find not her paths.
Right.
And that's talking about dispersed Israel.
Okay.
And you know, taken, deported Israel.
Yeah. Okay, now, and according to my research, because we can compare your numbers with mine at this point, I date this when Justinian established the monastery system and also gave the code that you were talking about at 529 A.D.
Yeah, right. That's close enough. I mean, it's within a year.
Okay. And so then this time and times and the dividing of time adds up, you know, with the property being 360 years per time. We're talking about a period of 1,260 years. If you add that to 529, you get 1789, the year of the French Revolution. The French Revolution was instrumental in taking away from the papacy all of its property in France. They beheaded Louis, okay, the Catholic king. And so the French Revolution was the beginning of the end for the papacy, for its certainly in terms of its military power in Europe, okay? And so do you have any comment on that?
Well, that's exactly right. And I believe that we saw that the first beast was dated by John.
Okay.
And Daniel here is dating the second beast.
Uh-huh.
The 3.5 times.
Okay.
John talked about the first beast in the 42 months in the first half of Revelation 13.
Okay. All right. So, and then that, we discussed that last time, I believe, and that was a reference to what again?
That's the reference to the series of empires, the first beast and the four empires and how long they would have hegemony.
Okay.
Over the world. And it's about 42 months. Well, first, from the founding to the fall of Rome is right around 1,260 years.
Okay.
Also from the rise of the Babylonian monarchy until the time of Justinian is right around 1,260.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, I just wanted to specify that to make it clear to people who didn't hear our previous show on that, okay? Verse 26, but the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it to the end, of course. Now talking about the French Revolution, they did take away his dominion.
Right, they took away the dominion of the papacy,
mm-hmm.
but not the papacy.
Right, the papacy still exists, that's right. Verse 27, and the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, ultimately being us, okay? That's who we are, the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Now, there's a prophecy, because obviously this kingdom has not been established yet.
Well, I think it has been established, but there are other prophecies in play
that
have prevented it.
Right. Well, certainly the first advent was
but from the time Napoleon took away the dominion from the papacy.
Okay, yes.
But he didn't rule. I mean, it wasn't but a couple of years and the Battle of Waterloo
1815
was the demise of Napoleon.
Right. Yes. Yes.
From that time on, the Anglo-Saxon peoples have had hegemony over the world.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of other things in play.
Right. Well, unfortunately, the House of Rothschild has been ruling most of our nations through usury.
Well, right.
This time. Yeah.
But in name and appearance, the Anglo-Saxons still have hegemony.
Yes, okay. Yes.
And the real throne of David still has hegemony in name and appearance.
Yes. Yes.
However,
in name and appearance, yes.
Yeah, however, there's a lot of other things in play.
Yeah, okay, yeah, and when we get into Revelation, we'll start discussing those. Verse 28, and this is the last verse of chapter 7. Thus far is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart, which is kind of a similar statement as to Daniel chapter 10, where he says, seal up the vision, it's not to be revealed until the time of the end, okay? So before we get into chapter 8, we're going to diverge into Revelation 13.
Right.
Okay.
From verse 11.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and read, because I'm turning the pages of my Bible here.
And I saw another beast ascending from out of the earth, and it had two horns like a lamb and spoke as a dragon. And this is very similar to the language that Daniel just used
mm-hmm.
concerning, you know, that we say is concerning the papacy
yes.
in Daniel 7. And all of the authority of the first beast, it practices in his presence. In other words, the Roman Empire was still there
mm-hmm.
in substance, but not in authority.
Yes.
And the papacy had now had the authority.
Okay.
Okay, so it had all the authority of the emperors, the popes. And it makes the earth and those dwelling in it that they shall worship the first beast who had been healed from the wound of its death.
Okay.
And he shall make a great sign that even fire would be made from heaven to descend to earth before men. Now I know that sounds fantastic, but this is the revelation.
Right.
And it's in symbols.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And I believe it represents all of the wars conducted against the children of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And Psalm 74:7 says, they have cast fire into thy sanctuary.
Yeah.
And Psalm 78:63, the fire consumed their young men. I think that the fire is metaphoric for warfare.
Sure, yeah. And spiritual warfare, too, and everything that makes us writhe in pain.
Well, right.
that they're doing to us, yes.
Right, it's like the fires that we're tested with in Peter. I mean, we don't really pass through actual fire, you know. Mm-hmm. Fire is a metaphor for the trials of life.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Verse 14. And he would deceive those dwelling upon the earth through the signs which have been given to him to make in the presence of the beast. And I think that this is a reference to, you know, all through the ages we've had these Catholic miracles.
Yes.
And as far as I'm concerned, if anyone's making signs, they're deceiving people.
Yeah.
Because real Christians don't need signs.
Yeah.
But
right.
We have sign after sign in the Catholic Church or claims of,
yeah,
of
that's right.
You know, like the miracle at Fatima and that's just the
yeah.
Probably the zenith of the Catholic deceptions.
Right, right. Okay, yeah.
Now I'll commence with verse 14, saying to those dwelling upon the earth to make an image for the beast who has the wound of the sword and has lived. And there had been given to him a spirit to the image of the beast in order that the image of the beast may also speak and may make it that as many as who would not worship the image of the beast should be slain. Yeah, you know, I think this accurately portrays the 30 Years' War and the papal interdicts
okay.
in the Middle Ages.
Sorry.
In the Middle Ages, the popes would issue these interdicts, and entire towns and villages would be put off limits to all Catholics.
Right.
Which was basically to all Europeans.
Yes. Yeah. Excommunication. Yes.
And it happened. They interdicted entire kingdoms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, England was interdicted for 5 years.
Right. Oh, it was. Okay.
Florence was interdicted at one point, and it caused a war, and it ended the reign of a certain pope.
Uh-huh.
I forget his name, but that's actually called, I think it's called the War of the Eight Saints or something like that.
Okay.
So literally, the pope was making war against the saints.
Right, right. And so the power of excommunication, that put the person who or town that was excommunicated in a serious bind. They could not do business with any other towns or people, and they were basically shut up. You know, it's like having a spiritual wall put around your house or your town.
Well, yeah. Right, but they also prevented all Catholics from even buying and selling to
exactly.
people under the interdict.
Exactly.
People couldn't buy or sell unless they worshiped the beast.
Right, that's right, that's right. Yeah, so they were cut off from the rest of the community. Economically, spiritually, they couldn't send letters to them. They were the interdict totally cut them off.
Right.
And this is a very powerful weapon they used. And basically, if you didn't agree with the Pope's theology, you had to face the interdict. It's as simple as that. So this was a very, very, very powerful stuff. Okay.
And now, I'd like to continue with 16, unless you're not done. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
And it makes all those who are small and those who are great and those who are wealthy and those who are poor and those who are free and those who are slaves, and they have been given to them an engraved mark upon their right hand or upon their forehead, and in order that one would not be able to buy or to sell if he has not the mark.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of the beast or the number of his name. Now, I don't think that's to be taken literally.
Okay.
I think that's a spiritual mark.
Okay.
I mean, I can't point at anything and say that's the mark.
Right.
But there were people that worshipped the papacy, and there still
sure.
are today.
Yes.
There
absolutely.
Are people that worship that false authority.
Yes.
That it's the power of the beast.
Yes. Yes.
And they're all the people that buy into the system and are entirely enamored by it and think that it's all good.
Right,
and
right.
they worship Obama today.
That's right,
and the Jews in
yeah.
The,
well,
in
he's
the
an ecumenist, actually. Now I think of it, because he claims to have been a Christian. He claims
yeah.
to be a Buddhist, or I mean, I'm sorry, a Muslim. He bowed before the Dalai Lama, if I remember correctly, and he's in reality he's a Jew. Okay, so he's your total ecumenical president. Yeah, yeah. But nevertheless, the numbers. Let me read verse 18. Here is wisdom. Let him that has understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. And it happens to be the case that the slogan on the papal mitre, you know, which is that cone head, that cone head hat that the popes wear, the slogan on there is Vicarius Filii Dei. Okay, Vicarius Filii Dei. And when you add up the Roman numerals of that name, they add up to 666.
Well, right. And mm-hmm. Let me say a few things about that.
Okay.
This, we always hear stuff about this guy's name adding up to 666 and that guy's name adding up to 666.
Yeah, Kissinger.
well, right. And you know, it's usually all bunk.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually a contrived manner in which it's used in order to make it so.
Yes.
And you know, here we have a Roman figurehead, the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the Latin language.
That's right.
Okay. And we have the Latin number system. And we have the title that the Pope wore on his garments.
That's right.
For thousands of years.
Yeah.
Vicarius Filii Dei.
Yeah, that's not coincidence, is it?
Well, you know, it's everything is owned by him. The language, the numeral system.
Yeah.
None of this is contrived.
That's
the
right.
The title, the fact that the title is on his garments to this day, none of this is contrived.
That's right.
It's a natural fit.
Mm-hmm.
And it adds up. When you add up the Roman numerals that have a value in the Roman numeral system in Vicarius Filii Dei, it comes out to 666.
Yes.
There's
yes.
no doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, and so yeah, I agree. We're not contriving anything here, as we would be in other cases. Yes, and you know, and everything fits. It points right at the papacy. There's absolutely no doubt about it that it points right to the papacy. Okay. Any more in the book of Revelation?
Well, no. I think we covered that well enough.
Yes.
I mean, it's what it says is what it says,
uh-huh.
And I think we've. I can't explain it any better.
Yeah.
But I think it's nailed. I mean, it's no doubt that this is right in line with the end of Daniel 7, and they both describe the papacy.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and people, skeptics may want to say that, well, this is just coincidence. But, you know, when you take the entire book of Daniel and the entire book of Revelation and add up the coincidences in consecutive order and the historical events that they obviously portray, there's no coincidence here. This is all divinely ordained. There's simply no doubt about it. Okay. All right. Daniel chapter 8, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, even to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first.
Now I'd like to say something right here.
Okay.
Now, the book of Daniel, obviously the scrolls are confused.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is, I mean, it's here, and it's a couple of times that Belshazzar is mentioned here. But, you know, in Daniel chapter 5, the Persians had already come to control
right.
Babylon.
Right, right. So these chapters are mixed up, yes.
Yeah, definitely. And this, you know, the chapters in Jeremiah in the Masoretic text are severely mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
But the Septuagint straightens that out.
Okay.
But, you know, in Daniel and the Septuagint, they're in the same order that they are here.
Uh-huh.
And they're obviously not in the correct order.
Right.
Because
right.
This,
not in the historical order. That's right.
Right. This should absolutely, these visions should have preceded the event
Darius.
Of Daniel 5.
That's right. It should have preceded Darius, because Darius slew Belshazzar.
And you know, Daniel probably wrote all this. You know, just the language here in 8:1 tells me that it was a fresh scroll.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Daniel may have wrote 8 books that make up what we know as the book of Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I never counted them, but he would have written them all on separate papyri scrolls at diverse times.
Yes. 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 Okay.
And when the later biblical I don't want to say editors isn't really the right name, but the collectors of manuscripts, when they put them together, they just didn't put them together in the
right. Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no doubt about it here. Okay, verse 2, and I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. Okay, so the two horns, now he's skipping what typically we would regard as the Babylonian Empire, okay, and now he's talking about these two horns. Aren't we again dealing here with the Medes and Persians?
Yes, and it even says it later. I mean, Daniel makes it easy.
Okay.
You know, at the end of the chapter.
It's usually not easy, is it?
yeah, right. Here he makes it easy. This is definitely the ram is definitely the Medes and the Persians, and the goat is the that we're about to encounter is Alexander the Great and the Macedonians.
Now one was higher than the other, and one came last, and so we have the Medes and the Persians.
Right, and he's just comparing the union between the Medes and the Persians.
Right,
and the Persians are obviously the higher of the two horns.
Okay, yeah, they were more powerful. Okay, verse 4, I saw the ram pushing west and northward and southward, so that no beasts might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. So we're still talking about this ram with two horns. See, this Persian Empire.
Well, right. And you know what's interesting is the Persian Empire never pushed eastward beyond the Indus River, which was always pretty much the natural boundary.
Okay.
You know, it never tried to go conquer China or
right.
India
exactly.
or anything like that.
Yeah.
And this pretty much describes it perfectly. And let me say something else too here. I have a note here. The Ulai, which is the river that Daniel is standing by when he
yes.
sees this vision. This is in Susiana.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, Daniel's not in Babylonia at this time.
Uh-huh.
He's far north in Susa.
Yeah, Elam is north, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, the Ulos River is a river known by the Greeks to be in Susiana near Susa.
Uh-huh, okay.
And he's saying he's in Shushan in the palace.
Yes.
So what I'm saying is that this place is definitely a historical place.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
But, you know, we know it from secular history,
uh-huh.
the place where Daniel is.
Yeah, and we found out, and you know, we talked about this before, that somebody just put on the I have to interrupt here, this business about organ theft. The Israelis have been stealing Ukrainian children and taking them to Israel for their organ parts. Okay, so Richtar just put the website up there if anybody else wants to look at that.
I actually have the entire I took a screenshot of that entire page
mm-hmm.
and put it on Chris DeGenio last night.
Yeah, it's incredible what they get away with. It's just simply incredible. organ harvesting. That's what these people are doing, folks. How can they possibly be God's chosen people?
And the sex slave trade.
Yeah.
It's incredible. They've been looting and pillaging Eastern Europe of young blonde girls for
right.
Ever since they got diplomatic, you know, national recognition and the immunity granted to nations to govern themselves in Palestine.
Yeah, we're talking 60 years. At least 60 years.
Right. It's a haven for criminals and all sorts of unclean beasts and crimes.
Yeah, so we pray to Yahweh that the eyes of our people be awakened and stop supporting the bandit state of Israel. You know, anyway, verse 5, and as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Now, what would this mean here, touched not the ground?
Well, I think it's a reference, you know, when you're running so fast, you don't look like you're touching the ground.
Right. Okay.
You know, and that's just the speed with which Alexander conquered the known world was quite remarkable.
It reminds me of an episode in the history of photography where there was this bet between two racehorsing fans, okay? And the one guy said that when a horse runs down a racetrack, he's never completely off the ground. His two of his feet are always on the ground, and before they lift up, the other 2 feet are on the ground, okay? And, of course, when the horse is running real fast, nobody could really know. You know, it looked like they were totally off the ground. But so when photography came in, they set up the camera at the finish line, right? And it clearly showed that all four of the horse's feet were off the ground as he crossed the finish line. You know, so, yes, this is a metaphor here. So saying that they moved so fast that, it was like lightning speed, okay? And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And, of course, that means Alexander, okay? Now, verse 6, and he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran to him in the fury of his power. Is there any indication from the reading you've done on this episode, that Alexander had a particular grudge against the Medes and Persians, because this implies that...
Well, yes, he did.
Okay.
Because there was the invasion by Xerxes,
okay,
of Greece, and the Greeks, you know, decisively defeated the Persians, even though they were outnumbered 10 or 15 to 1.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Now the... after that, the Persians never had the power to invade Greece again like they did under Xerxes.
Mm-hmm.
However, the Persians agitated and instigated all throughout the Peloponnesian Wars.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
From the 450s all the way down, and most of the Peloponnesian Wars happened in the 430s and the 420s.
Okay.
But from the time they recovered from the defeat of Xerxes, under Artaxerxes later on, they began agitating the Athenians and the Spartans against each other.
Uh-huh.
And they were like the Poland was in World War II.
Yeah.
You know, Poland agitated Germany and started the whole thing off.
Right.
It's well, the Persians were constantly agitating the Athenians against the Spartans and the Spartans against the Athenians. And I mean, that there was a lot of animosity there anyway, and because it was really a tribal rivalry.
Yes.
Because the
yes.
Athenians were really Ionians and the Spartans were Dorians.
Yes.
And there was a lot of friction between the two tribes.
Right.
And that's the real cause of the Peloponnesian War.
Okay.
Was which tribe would dominate, you know, the West. But
right.
it ended up that they wore each other down, and neither of them did.
Yeah.
Because Philip of Macedon just basically walked into Greece.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I mean, he didn't have a whole lot of resistance when he conquered the Greek states, and he was Alexander's father.
Right.
But Alexander, you know, the Greeks never forgot all of the instigation and the abrasion and the trouble that the Persians had caused during
yes.
the Peloponnesian Wars.
Yes.
Now it's actually I have to get into this.
Okay.
The Greeks realized how soft Persia had gotten.
Okay.
In the March of the 10,000.
Yeah.
You know, the Greeks wrote all the time about how austerity made for a tough race of men.
It's kind of like America has grown soft in the last
exactly.
200 years.
And the same thing with Rome.
Yes.
In the second and third centuries AD.
That's right.
And there's no doubt austerity makes for a tough race of men.
Yeah.
And luxury and wealth make for a weak, effeminate race of men.
That's right.
There is no doubt. I mean, it is so evident all throughout
yeah.
history.
Right.
And today, right, the majority of Americans are wealthy, soft, and weak.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, I see that when I walk the streets of this small town I live in. I see so many men that look like women. It's incredible.
Well, yeah, we're all overweight because of the lousy diets and
they're
chemicals.
Overweight. They get no exercise. They're,
right.
they're soft as hell.
That's right. That's right. The only exercise we get is the push button on our remote.
Right. And when you see men walking around Walmart in pajama bottoms,
right.
it's just ridiculous.
That's the latest fashion, Bill. What's
yeah,
the matter with
it's,
you?
It's terrible.
Okay.
Now the
yeah.
there's a couple other things.
Okay.
Well, Xenophon wrote about it in the Anabasis, where there was an inter-family rivalry when Darius Nassus took the throne in Persia. and Nathus means the bastard.
Okay.
And he had a more legitimate half-brother, Cyrus, who was appointed over the western provinces in Anatolia.
Uh-huh.
And Cyrus wanted to take the throne from his brother. So he actually hired 10,000 Greek mercenaries.
Uh-huh.
And Xenophon, the historian, was one of their generals. And he, you know, they were hired to go march against Darius Nathus. And they did as part of a much larger army.
Uh-huh.
And on the first day of battle, Cyrus was killed.
Okay.
Now, this, as soon as Cyrus was killed, all of the Persian forces on Cyrus' side fled.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And blended in with the rest of the Persians, basically.
Okay.
And the 10,000 Greeks that were hired to fight in this battle were on their own.
Yeah.
And Darius Nathus made him an offer. He said, lay down your arms and you could be my friends.
Okay.
Well, they're like, well, we're not crazy.
Yeah, right.
We're not laying down our arms. If we're going to be your friends, you're going to be our friends with our arms, or we're fighting our way out of here.
Right, right.
And that's what they did.
Okay.
They fought their way from Babylonia all the way back to Greece.
Uh-huh.
And they made it.
Wow.
About 8,000 of them made it.
Okay.
So when the later Greeks realized that 8,000 Greeks fought their way through Persia,
uh-huh.
Well, Alexander got it in his mind that he could defeat the entire empire with 40,000 soldiers.
Right.
That's what he did.
Yeah, that's right.
When he attacked Persia,
yeah,
he only brought 40,000 soldiers.
Uh-huh.
Now, by comparison, almost, 150 years before that, when Xerxes came, and I mean, the numbers are probably inflated because the victors write the history, right?
Sure.
Well, when Xerxes came into Greece from Persia, Herodotus attributes to him having like 1.8 million soldiers and 2,500 ships.
Okay. Yeah, it's a pretty sizable army. Yeah.
So that's
uh-huh.
Well, that's the difference.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. Well, yeah. So
the
40,000 men—that's pretty incredible accomplishment that they can defeat a kingdom like that. You know. But
yeah, but that's the, you know, that's, it became soft and luxurious.
Right, right, right. And then, what people, and
that's, I'm sorry, if 2 million Chinamen rolled over to the Canadian border tomorrow or the Mexican border, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, most of this country would just throw their arms up in despair.
That's right.
Because that's what we become, soft and luxurious.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that there's a core of good old boys in the center of the country that would probably stick it out.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. No
but
doubt.
These people on the coasts.
Yeah, or in the cities.
And in the big cities, they're just useless.
That's right. That's right. They don't even suspect that there's a problem. Right. Yeah, so Alexander, that was a major accomplishment. I would say, in addition, as Alexander fought his way further and further east, he did make allies with some Scythian tribes and perhaps even some Parthian tribes, and he was able to ally them with his army, okay? So he was able to add more troops to his army as he traveled, okay?
Well, of course, and that always happened.
Yeah.
With the conquering army.
Yeah.
There's, but to start out with 40,000 men is pretty incredible.
That's right. It's absolutely incredible. Okay, all right, verse 7. And I saw him come close to the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, meaning great anger, obviously, and smote the ram and broke his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. So, again, we're being told that Alexander had, with great fury and anger, had a real grudge against the Medes and Persians. Were they responsible for the death of his father? Is that what's going on here?
No. They weren't responsible for the death of Philip of Macedon. I'm embarrassed. I really forget exactly how Philip of Macedon died.
Okay.
he was blind in one eye.
Uh-huh.
From a battle scar. I mean, he was a tough old man. I don't exactly remember exactly how he died.
But as you were explaining, because of the raids that the Persians were making into Greece.
Well, they were agitating.
Yeah.
They were getting the Athenians, politically. It was mostly political agitation.
Mm-hmm.
That they were, inciting the Athenians against the Spartans and vice versa.
Right, yeah. So Alexander was just getting even with them. is a pestilence. They were a pestilence to Greece.
Yes, and there's a piece of hidden history also there.
Okay.
In the Alexander story. And he went all the way to India.
Yes.
And fought battles with the Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned back, and it's not clear exactly why he turned back, but Diodorus Siculus says he made treaties.
Okay.
And turned back and left fortresses strung along the Afghani plains and the plains of modern Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yeah.
The Indus River was always the historical border between what you'd call the Persian realm of influence and the
yes.
Indian realm of influence.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
The
okay.
Well, basically there's a metal exchange problem in Europe that's affecting Europe.
Okay.
At this time. And this is very hard to document, but it seems that the exchange rate from gold to silver was much lower in India. In India, you could go and you could buy a piece of gold for 7 pieces of silver.
Okay.
But a piece of gold was worth 20 pieces of silver in the West.
Yeah. So
and the Jews in Babylon, because Babylon had a great number of Jews.
How did I know you were going to say that word?
Well, the Jews in Babylon basically controlled the trade routes between the East and the West.
Hey, if we can buy it in one town and sell it in the other, boy, can we make a profit.
Right. And mm-hmm. and there's a lot of indication that Alexander's impetus for going all the way to India was because he wanted the West to stop bleeding gold to the East through the hands of the Jews in Babylon.
Interesting.
Because if you could take a piece of, if you could take 7 pieces of silver and get a piece of gold in Rome
mm-hmm.
and go to India and trade that in for 20 pieces of silver.
Yeah.
And go take those 20 pieces of silver back to Rome, and go like that all day.
Yeah, exactly. You're making profit.
Right.
Hand over fist. Well, isn't that what the Rothschilds did with Roosevelt?
Well, that's how George Soros made his currency exchanges and
they do that all the time.
Yeah, that's the Jews have been bleeding us dry for thousands of years with their international trade.
That's right.
That we don't normally really eat.
Yeah, the people within the nations don't have no idea that this is going on and how
right.
it affects them.
Until they're blood dry.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So what Roosevelt did to America was he forbade the American citizens to own at least a certain amount of gold over a certain amount, okay? They couldn't have it in their possession, so they had to turn it in, and at a very low price, of course, okay? And then, the Jews, the international Jews, bought it at this very low price. And then on the open market, they sold it for, 3 or 4 times as much, okay?
Right.
That's how they operate.
And Anglo-Saxon or Caucasian people aren't normally crafty international dealers.
That's right. We've never learned that.
and the Jews, the Jews have, that's been their trick for 7,000 years now.
Yes. It goes all the way back to Babylon.
The Canaanite merchants.
Yeah,
that's why the word Canaanite became synonymous with the word merchant.
That's right. Merchant trafficker. That's what it says in Strong's Concordance. One of the definitions of Canaanite. Yes. Okay. All right. Verse 8. Therefore, the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up 4 notable ones toward the 4 winds of heaven. We talked about, because this was mentioned earlier, that his 4 generals divided up his empire when he died.
Right. Antigonus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Seleucid.
Lysimachus, I believe.
Lysimachus. He was actually a...
Okay, now verse 9. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. Okay, so one of these 4 generals became greater than the other 3. Who are we talking about here?
Well, I don't think it's talking about them at all.
Okay.
And this is why. And I know that a lot of people try to apply this to Seleucus.
Yes.
But, the Seleucids, who would actually be the successors to Antigonus.
Okay.
Several hundred years later.
Right.
Antigonus received all of Asia. He was the general of Alexander's that received Asia. And eventually that became the empire of the Seleucids.
Right.
Now the and they did harass greatly the people in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And caused the rise of the Maccabees.
Right.
There's no doubt. And they defiled the Second Temple.
Right.
There's
right.
no doubt. But I don't think this applies to them.
Okay.
And that's because of verse 23.
Okay.
You see, right now we're only reading the vision.
Right, right.
But later on in the chapter is the interpretation of the vision.
Okay, okay.
Okay? Well, and verse 23 actually says an interpretation of this, and in the later time of their kingdom,
yeah.
when the transgressors are coming to a full, or come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up.
Okay. Okay.
And I don't think that's Antiochus Epiphanes.
Okay.
Go on.
Let me read through verse 12 here and give the conventional interpretation of what's being said here. Okay.
Okay.
So verse 10, and it waxed great. We're talking about this little horn, which but let me just back up to verse 9. And out of one of them, okay, it doesn't say one of them. It says out of one of them. So your point is well taken, okay? And out of one of them came forth a little horn which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. Now, if it's Antiochus Epiphanes, which almost everybody says that this is being referred to, let's continue reading. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. And, of course, he was a mighty military victor, verse 11. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of the sanctuary was cast down. And now, if the conventional interpretation is correct, we're talking about Jerusalem. And a host was given to him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Okay, so the daily sacrifice being taken away would be a reference to when Antiochus Epiphanes stopped the Maccabees from practicing their daily sacrifice, and he went and slaughtered a pig on the on the altar. That's the conventional interpretation. You're not in agreement with that interpretation.
No, I'm not in agreement with it at all, and
okay.
mostly because of the way this is interpreted later in the chapter.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I believe that this, you know, the pleasant land, the people that interpret this as Antiochus Epiphanes,
mm-hmm.
which is just about all of the mainstream commentators.
Yes, yes.
They're all very Jew-centric.
Okay.
Okay? They believe that it's only the Jews or what we would know to be the 40,000 returnees to Jerusalem.
Right.
None of whom were really Jews. They were Judah. And
that's right. They were Judah, not Jews.
Oh, yeah. Okay. However, we know that,
uh-huh.
and we know that the real sanctuary and that the real mass of his people, of the people of God, are long in Europe by now.
Yes.
That's the pleasant land.
Yes.
Okay, and I will make this perfectly clear in the second half of the chapter where this is interpreted.
Okay, well, so let me continue reading here, because you're saying, you're just talking about future events, okay?
Well, I believe that this daily sacrifice was taken away and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. That is only prophetic language
mm-hmm.
signifying a forced change of religion
okay.
portrayed in Daniel's terms.
Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. Verse 13. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said to that certain saint which spoke, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and to the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said to me, to 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. And, of course, let me give the conventional interpretation before you comment here. And these interpreters usually refer to, I don't know how well they established this. This is just what I've read a few times. That from the day that Antiochus Epiphanes slaughtered the pig on the altar, his rule over the Maccabees was a period of 2,300 days. That's what their interpretation is. And I don't know if they've been able to establish, that succinctly. So what do you have to say to that?
Well, it's actually they try to establish that by taking the 2,300 days.
Okay.
And it actually is, in the Hebrew, it's 23,000 evenings and mornings.
23,000?
I'm sorry, 2,300 evenings
right.
and mornings.
Okay.
Which a lot of people try to claim are 1,150 days.
Okay.
And I'm going to say that they have that there's some indication that they can do that, you know, as the book of Genesis says, the evening and the morning were the first day. The evening and the morning were the second day.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But this, the way this phrase is worded in Hebrew, this is the only way place that it appears in the Bible in that manner.
Okay.
And the Septuagint, the people that translated the Hebrew into Greek, they actually wrote evenings and mornings, 2,300 days.
Okay.
So they interpreted to mean 2,300 days.
Mm-hmm.
And not 1,150 evenings and 1,150 mornings.
Okay.
Which is what a lot of modern interpreters try to do.
All right.
And
so
three and a half years,
half. Yeah.
Basically, after Antiochus Epiphanes had spoiled the temple, it laid idle apparently for about 3.5 years.
Okay.
And they try to say that's the 1,150 days.
Oh, okay. So that's
the 2,300 evenings and mornings.
Yeah.
But I just don't see it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a stretch to divide it in half. It really is. Okay.
Well, yeah, there's actually a few things that they're stretching here.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. And I really sincerely believe that it'll be clear that this is Muhammad and Islam when we read the description of the chapter.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, when we read the interpretation of this vision at the end of the chapter, the second half
right.
of the chapter.
Okay,
okay.
Well, let me continue here. I'll see if you have more to say before I go to verse 15.
No, you can go to verse 15. I'm just going to say that
if
anybody wants the details on this, Clifton Emmaheiser in Watchman's Teaching Letter number 55
okay.
at emmaheiser.christiagenia.org, you know, he covered this. I think it's two, Watchman Teaching Letters, numbers 54 and 55. He covered all this in great length.
Uh-huh. Okay. Very good. All right. Verse 15. And it came to pass when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. Okay. So now, we've been given the vision, and now we're being given the understanding. Verse 17. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell upon my face. But he said to me, understand, O son of man, for at that time of the end shall be the vision. So it sounds like we're talking about far off. Now,
it is far off. And you know, that word end, it's the Hebrew word acharis usually, and it's a metaphor for the future.
Okay.
You know, but it usually refers to the distant future.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Verse 18. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright. And he said, behold, I will make you know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, okay, of this vision here. It's got to be what he's talking about. For at the time appointed, the end shall be. The ram, which you saw having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia. Okay? So there it spells it out. Okay? So you can't get that wrong, right, folks? You can't get that wrong. Verse 21. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king, obviously, Alexander. Verse 22. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. Of course, they were not as powerful as Alexander. Verse 23, and in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. Okay, so now we're talking about the latter time of their kingdom. Okay, now, can this be projected beyond when the Romans, in a series of wars, basically took over the kingdom, the territories away from the Greeks around 168 BC?
Yes, they did.
Okay. So,
And they actually didn't take the territories away from the Seleucids until about 70 BC.
Okay, okay. So how far in the future now are we projecting this latter time of their kingdom, as it's stated here in verse
23? Well, those kingdoms still existed for the most part, even though, and they existed as kingdoms, and then later some of them existed as provinces,
yeah,
while others were still kingdoms, all throughout the Roman Empire.
Yeah, and many of them, many of those towns and villages and districts still spoke Greek and lived Greek lives.
Well, right, and
yeah,
and when the Romans fell apart, the Greeks were still there.
Yeah,
except that by then they were calling themselves Romans.
Right,
because Roman Greek, that they were the same culture.
Yeah. Okay. So this verse 23 does not necessarily pinpoint the transition from Greece to Rome in 168 AD, or if you want to take it to 70
Well,
AD.
I don't think it does.
Okay.
And the transition from Greece to Rome was a long...
Yeah, it was a process.
Was itself took over 100 years.
Yeah, it was a long process. Okay, verse 24, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power, and he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper, and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. Okay, in defense of your position here, I can't say that the Greeks destroyed the holy people. You know,
no,
we had wars. Okay,
the Greeks never destroyed the holy people, and
yeah,
neither did the Romans.
Right, right. The Romans were part of the holy people.
Right,
and so were the Greeks. Yes. Okay. So, but I'm intrigued by this statement here. Let me read verse 24 again, the first part of it. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, it's hard to make of that. But Muhammad, he had convinced people, and he didn't have the strength himself. He was run out of Mecca.
Okay.
Okay. But he convinced people through religion that they should join him and conquer by the sword.
Yes.
And most of that conquering went on after he had died.
Yeah.
And they just continued to conquer.
Right.
And he shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper in practice and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people.
Uh-huh.
And Islam was a war of the Arab peoples against the white race is what it turned into.
Right.
Because
right,
most of the lands that they conquered were held by white,
mm-hmm,
white Syrians, white Romans, white Persians.
Right, I was just getting ready to say the old Greco-Roman Empire.
well, right.
Yeah.
The Romans and Greeks and Phoenicians, yeah, of North Africa were all white, and Islam destroyed all of that.
Yes.
And the next, verse 25, and to his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand,
uh-huh,
and he shall magnify himself in his heart,
uh-huh,
and peace, and by peace, shall destroy many.
Mm-hmm.
And Islam is the religion of peace.
Yeah, right.
Okay?
Okay?
And he shall also stand up against the prince of princes,
mm-hmm,
but he shall be broken without hand.
Yeah.
Now, standing up against the prince of princes,
okay,
only Muhammad did that. He's the only one. I mean, outside of the Jews themselves,
yes,
he actually destroyed many by peace, because Islam's the religion of peace. Peace, as
yeah,
long as everybody's a Muslim.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And he actually is the only one. I mean, a lot of the Jews, they deny Christ was God.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't put themselves between Christ and God.
Yeah.
Muhammad actually announced that Christ was a prophet,
yeah,
but that he was the first prophet.
Okay.
And Christ wasn't God. He denied the divinity of Christ.
Right, he just lowered him to the level of a prophet, yeah.
And nobody fits that description like Muhammad.
Okay.
Okay?
Right.
I'd like to, you know, from Clifton Emma Heiser's Watchman's Teaching Letter number 54, he quotes William V. Fowler, who did a very good exposition on this long before I came along.
Okay, I've got the book right here, The End Time Revelation.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, okay, well, go ahead.
Well, I don't have that open to that page, so.
okay, well, he basically says, in his vision, Daniel saw that the little horn waxed exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, towards the west, and toward the pleasant land, arising south of Palestine from beginnings in Arabia. The followers of Muhammad immediately after his death in 632 AD attacked the Persians in the east before entering Palestine and capturing Jerusalem in 637 AD. Subsequent expansion was rapid, and within 100 years, the Saracens, as they were called, had acquired an empire extending from India to the Atlantic, including all the territory south of the Mediterranean and east of Palestine as far as Central Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and it cast down, he's quoting Daniel again,
yes,
and it cast down some of the host and the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. As we have seen, the prince of the host is to be identified with Jesus Christ, so the stars must be the children of Yahweh. I would say that the stars of heaven are almost always in prophecy the children of Yahweh.
Yes.
And the children of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's in Deborah. It's throughout the Revelation in several places.
Right, Revelation 12 for sure.
Right.
Yes.
This prophecy accurately describes the attitude of the Muslims to the Christian communities that remained within their territories.
Yes.
During the 10-year rule of Omar, the second caliph, which Muhammad was the first, and this was from 634 to 644, 4,000 churches were destroyed, and the Christians were humiliated.
Yes.
As a sign of degradation, they were made to wear clothes of less honorable color, and instead of horses, they were made to ride on asses.
Mm-hmm.
He magnified himself to the prince of the host. As we have seen, the prince of the host is Jesus Christ,
yes,
and this is confirmed by the interpretation which calls him the Prince of Princes,
mm-hmm,
a title that can only be given to Jesus Christ. Although Muslims claim to worship the same God as Christians, the Quran says that they are infidels who say that Christ is God.
Yeah.
Jesus is said to be no more than a servant who is favored with the gift of prophecy, while the Muslim creed declared a belief in God and Muhammad,
yeah,
next after God, as superior to Jesus Christ.
Right.
The Muslims have clearly magnified themselves against Jesus Christ, the, mm-hmm, Prince of the Host.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Very good. Let me back up to verse 24, and let me try to propose a couple of interpretations where it says, "And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power." Okay, and you offered the suggestion that, well, he was surrounded by a group of people. For one thing, he was illiterate. So he did not have the ability to encode. He did not write the Quran. Okay.
Well, right. First, half the Quran is plagiarized.
Right. By
Jews. And did you ever read the Quran? Did you ever read some of that?
I was just getting ready to say that what he did, he hired some writers to do it, and they were Jews. And these Jews put the Quran together for him, so it was not under his own power. He hired these Jews to do it. And they just, you know, lifted, as you said, they plagiarized a lot of the Old Testament and then made up a lot of new stuff.
Well, it's recorded by Gibbon, and the historian of Rome, and many others that Muhammad was a Jew, at least on his mother's side.
Okay. I had
and
not heard that before.
Possibly on his father. Well, all of his wives were Jews, too.
Okay.
Okay.
Stalin.
Well, right, and his mother was a Jewish, from the Zarahites.
Oh, okay.
They claimed to be Zarahites anyway.
Yeah, right.
That fled Palestine after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, went into Arabia.
Right. Yeah. Okay, but there's one more possible interpretation here, and that is given by Muhammad himself, that he struggled in his own mind. He wasn't sure whether the angel he was talking to was Gabriel or some kind of demon. He actually thought he was demon-possessed, okay? So there might have been some demon possession going on here, and that's where he got there must have been some kind of satanic power here. You know, it could be being mentioned here in verse 24, okay? So there's a couple of possible different interpretations. All right. Now, what? Getting back to verse 25. But he shall be broken without hand. What do you think that means?
Well, that his and I don't know if it's done yet, But I would think that it means that everything that he makes just eventually self-destructs or falls apart.
Right, right. Yeah, and I could say that even today, with all the different sects within Mohammedanism, and a lot of them being, you know, warring against each other.
Oh, they would kill each other. There's
right.
no doubt.
Right.
Even in prison, they kill each other.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Well, you have the Nation of Islam, and then you have the black Muslims, and then you have the real Arab terrorists who want nothing to do with any of them. And,
yeah.
And you have the Sunnis and the Shiites and
the Sufis. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're all divided. They're cut up worse than American Protestants.
Yeah, right. Well, at least we don't hack each other to pieces, not anymore.
Well, right, yeah. An evangelical and a Mormon would get along a lot better.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Verse 26, "And the vision of the evening and the morning, which is told is true, wherefore shut you up the vision, for it shall be for many days." Okay, so more verification that this is a long time in the future and not only 2,300 literal days, okay? And verse 27, "And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days, and afterward I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it." Okay, now I want to get back to the 2,300 days.
I still don't understand it. You might, but I still don't.
Well, the 2,300 days, if we're talking about Islam, and the 2,300 days comes to an end, where is the beginning point of the 2,300 days, and where is the end point? What time period
are
we talking about?
Well, it's difficult to say here, because the beginning point, it could actually be when Daniel's given the vision.
Okay.
Okay, which means the end point happened 200 years ago.
Okay. Well, now, if according to my reckoning, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, and we talked about this earlier.
That's 550 B.C.
550 B.C. Okay. And so we go 2,300 years from there.
That's 1750 A.D.
1750. What happened in 1750? Was that the Caliph of Baghdad? What happened in 1750?
I'm not sure. I'm not a historian of that period. I know I tried to bring it to the to see if it would go up to the last siege of, you know, the last the last time that the Turks, who are Muslims, tried to defeat us in Europe was the siege of Vienna in 1683.
Okay.
But that's not quite enough. It's not 2,300 years.
Right. Yeah. It's pretty obvious that by 1750, the Muslim world really did not have much impact in Europe anymore.
Well, they do again today, though.
They do again today. That's right.
You know,
thanks to the
sanctuary isn't really cleansed.
Mm-hmm.
And I had thought, you know, whatever the beasts do, they do.
Yeah.
And I thought possibly this is talking about it's possible this is talking about cleansing the sanctuary, meaning getting rid of all the Israelite people who were defiling Jerusalem.
Okay.
With their idols and all of that. And Islam did do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It got rid of the people of God from out of the sanctuary who were defiling it.
Yeah.
And what the beasts do, Yahweh doesn't care about.
Yeah. Yeah.
He doesn't care about they're disgusting and violent. They're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
He expects dogs to act like dogs, in other words.
Right. Right. Yeah,
now, that would be very close to 1,150 years.
Okay.
From the time that Daniel's given to this vision to the time that that Islam actually takes Jerusalem is very. It's like 1,180 years.
Mm-hmm.
But even that doesn't seem to fit the bill.
Okay.
So
I think the difficulty here is determining the exact starting point of this vision.
Right.
And maybe let me crunch some numbers during the next week and see if I can find some significant starting points.
Right. I tried to work it out, and I just can't see it.
Yeah.
And you know, you can't see a prophecy until you're sure of
its
fulfillment.
Yeah, right. Until it's pretty much obvious. That's right.
And if the 2,300 years aren't up, we're never going to see it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But if it's talking about Islam, there are several, you know, periods of changeover before Islam. In fact, I think Howard B. Rand, he dates the end of the caliphate around 1921. Okay? And so we're talking about, you know, the two major thrusts of Islam coming to, you know, with Turkish Islam, you know, coming to a complete end in that year, you know. So if that's what's implied here, we just have to count back 2,300 years and see what the starting point, where the starting point is, you know.
Well, so, maybe the temporal rule of Turkish Islam.
Right, right, yes, yes. Yeah, and of course, toward the end of World War One, we know that the international forces of banking have ruled the world from that point on. You know, there's simply no doubt about that, and that includes the end of the Ottoman Empire. Yes, troublemaker, that's what we're talking about, yes. So let me crunch some numbers during the week, and maybe I can come up with something here to resolve this mystery of the 2,300 days, okay?
Right, and I attempted, and I really couldn't see anything.
Yeah,
I can admit when I don't know something, and this is something I definitely don't know.
No, you must assert yourself.
Well, yeah, if I was John Hagee or...
Right, there you go.
One of those clowns.
just say, that's the year that we all must become Jews.
Jewish
Christians.
Right, well, yeah. Right.
That's the second coming.
I really wanted to bring this into Revelation chapter 9.
Okay.
And I don't know how much time we're going to have.
Well, we've got 15 minutes if you want to, you know, we can, before we get into, Revelation 9 or Daniel 9?
Well, Revelation 9 goes right hand in. I believe Revelation 9 is talking about the rise of Islam also.
Oh, okay.
And the fifth angel sounded the trumpet, and I saw a star from heaven falling to earth, and to him had been given the key of the bottomless pit, and he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke ascended from the pit like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air had become darkened from the smoke of the pit. And from the smoke, locusts came out into the earth. And authority had been given to them, like the scorpions of the earth have authority. And it had been spoken to them in order that they do not injure the grass of the earth or any green thing or any tree. So these aren't real locusts, because real locusts would devour all this.
Exactly,
all that.
They would, yes.
And let me, you know, from the NASA Earth Observatory, I have a paragraph. Alone, the desert locust is nothing to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
Of course it isn't. Locusts are never a threat alone.
Right.
It is a solitary creature that stays out of sight munching on plants.
Right.
But when enough locusts are packed into a small area, they form aggressive swarms that migrate from place to place, consuming all the vegetation in their path.
Yes.
And the transformation from solitary insect to plaguing swarm happens when conditions force the locusts into close confinement.
Mm-hmm.
Along the shores of the Red Sea, the locusts' winter breeding area, swarms develop when rains fall on the sandy soil to initiate the hatching of locust eggs.
Okay.
If conditions are right, plenty of water and vegetation for food, in the locust breeding areas, a large number of insects hatch and form swarms. Arabia was famous for these locust swarms.
Yes.
And that's why I brought up that paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Now the Arabia is basically the land of the desert locust.
That's right.
And from the smoke, locusts come out. I'm reading from Revelation again.
Yes.
Locusts came out into the earth, and authority had been given to them, like the scorpions of the earth have authority, and it had been spoken to them in order that they do not injure the earth, the grass of the earth, nor any green thing, nor any tree, except those men who do not have the seal of Yahweh upon their foreheads.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been given to them that they should not kill them, but they shall be tested for 5 months.
Yes.
And their torment is as the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. And in those days men shall seek death, and they shall not find it, and they shall desire to die, yet death shall flee from them.
Yes, sir. Yeah,
now,
so
now
those days are over, right?
well, right. The 5 months is 150 prophetic years.
Mm-hmm.
And the Islamic conquest by the Arabs lasted from approximately 628 or 629 to 786 A.D.
Okay.
And by 786 A.D., the military conquest of the Arab Islamists was completed. And that's right around 150 years.
Okay. Okay.
And the likeness of the locusts are like horses having been prepared for war, and upon their heads crowns like gold, and their faces as the faces of men, and they add hair as the hair of women, which
long
would describe, well, an Arab with the traditional dress.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that they all have those turbans, those long flowing turbans on their heads or whatever you want to call them. And their teeth were as teeth of lions, and they had breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings is the sound of many chariot teams of horses running into battle, and they had tails and stingers like scorpions, and the power is in their tails to injure men for 5 months, and they have over them a king, the messenger of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek he has a name, Destroyer, or Apollyon, and that means destroyer.
Yeah.
One woe has departed. Behold, there come yet two woes after these things.
Okay.
Now, I believe that woe ended in 786 AD.
Okay, so that would be the Arabian Muslims we're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. And the Muslims. Sixth messenger sounded the trumpet.
Yeah.
And I heard one voice from the four horns of the golden altar before Yahweh, saying to the sixth messenger, he having the trumpet, release the four messengers who were bound by the great river Euphrates. And the four messengers had been released who had been prepared for that hour and day and month and year that they should kill a third of the men. Now, an hour, I mean, if we go to prophetic day is a year, then an hour, a day, and a month and a year is like 391 years and 15 days.
Okay.
So bear that in mind, 391 years. And the number of the armies of the horsemen is 200 million.
Yeah.
And I heard the number of them. Now, once we see that this took place over several centuries, or 4 centuries, the size of that army isn't so fantastic.
Right, right.
Oh, okay. And thus I saw the horses in the vision, and those sitting upon them having fiery red and hyacinth and yellow breastplates, and the heads of the horses as the heads of lions, and from their mouths came out fire and smoke and sulfur.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a perfect description, and Howard Rand brought it up first, as far as I know, of the Turkish cannon that destroyed Constantinople.
Yes, yes.
From these three plagues, a third of the men had been killed. And I would say that this is when the fall of a third of the Christian world occurred,
Okay.
Which is what the Turks and the Arabs destroyed.
Yeah.
They destroyed a third of Christianity.
Yeah,
from the fire and from the smoke and from the sulfur coming out from their mouths. For the power of the horses is in their mouths and in their tails like serpents having heads, and with them they injure. The Turks crossed the Euphrates and took Baghdad by 1057 AD.
Okay.
By 1071, they held most of Anatolia. And by the 1300s, they held most of the Balkans.
Yeah.
But Constantinople didn't fall until 1453.
Right, right. So what we're talking about here is the southeastern portion of true Israel.
Well, right.
The white race that was overrun by these Muslims.
And it was overrun by the Turks over a period of 396 years by our reckoning.
Okay.
And a year and a month.
Yeah.
And a day is 391 years. So,
right.
So I mean, that's close enough for me. I don't.
Yeah, right. That's not good enough, Bill. You got to do better than that.
and this, you know, Revelations from 920, it perfectly describes the Byzantine Roman culture. And the rest of the men, those who had not been killed by these plagues, did not even repent from the works of their hands that they do not worship demons and idols and things of gold and things of silver and things of copper. And it's not talking about the Islamists. It's talking about the Christians.
Right, right.
You know, the idols in the Byzantine and the Catholic churches are it's never-ending idolatry.
Yeah. Well, even if it's not exactly idol worship in the sense that they were worshiping little figurines and getting, trying to get benefits, spiritual benefits or demonic benefits.
Well, I look back on my Catholic years, and I believe that they were.
Okay.
I mean.
Yeah, well, but on the other hand, you know, by selling this stuff, making merchandise of Christianity, you know, that would be idolatry too.
Right,
you know?
But it's worshiping the Creator more than the creation, more than the Creator.
Right.
The Mary worship and all the saints and the statues and I believe that it's idolatry.
Yeah, and this verifies for me because it's really obvious that even in the Old Testament, Yahweh says, "I chastise those whom I love," and He constantly is punishing the Israelites by bringing invading armies in. to, you know, punish them for their disobedience.
Well, right, and to look at, you know, to look at the, it's remotely possible that Daniel 8 alludes to Antiochus Epiphanes, but I seriously doubt it, because the prophecies are about Yahweh's punishment and his relationship with Israel, and those 40,000 returnees, even though they built the temple, even though their descendants supplied the apostles and the Christ, they're hardly Israel.
Yeah.
You know, they're only a sliver of Israel.
Yeah, and I can see that the Christian Israelites who stayed in the southeast and in Turkey, in Arabia, in Khazaria, you know, that area of the world, and, of course, the Balkans, that there was a lot of idol worship going on. There's a lot of witchcraft, you know, Transylvania, that kind of thing going on, and that Yahweh was using the Muslims to punish them, to chastise them for this type of activity. That's clearly what's being implied here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just like he had used the Moabites back in the days of the judges, you know.
Right.
Same thing.
Yeah. And a lot of Christians don't want to accept the fact that Yahweh does this to his people, you know. Yahweh wouldn't do that. That's Old Testament stuff. Here we're seeing in the New Testament. So they're wrong. They're wrong. Yahweh is a vengeful God.
Well, right.
Yeah, he is.
This is a perfect description of the conquest, the Islamic conquest.
Yes.
And it's the historical view of Revelations. And this is part, you know, the next chapter is chapter 10 in Revelation, the opening of the little book. And that's the Reformation.
That's right.
And it's very clear to me that in, you know, means to describe the Reformation.
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt. Yeah, the little book is the invention of the printing press and the shrinking of all those giant scrolls into a little book. That's right. That's exactly what it's talking about. Yeah. But we'll discuss that when we get into the book of Revelation, whenever that is. Okay. All right. So I see we've only got about 5 minutes left. So why don't we just call it an evening here. We've gotten to the end of Daniel chapter 8, and chapter 9, as far as I'm concerned, is the big chapter of Daniel, because we're going to be getting into Daniel 70 weeks and the Messiah prophecies.
Right. We'll definitely be I have to lay out my Ezra and Nehemiah chronology and the whole, and that's going to take some time.
Okay.
We might spend 2 weeks on Daniel 9.
Okay. Yeah, because it's a very important chapter, absolutely critical chapter, because the Judeo-Christian world has made mincemeat of Daniel chapter 9 in projecting the last 3.5 years into the future, you know, so that the so-called Antichrist is yet to come. Okay, that's
right.
Why
he's
they
been
do that.
Here all along.
Yes, and he's been here
no
all along.
No doubt, he's
that's,
been here all
why,
along.
That's why they distort Daniel chapter 9 to make that ridiculous prophecy, so we won't see it. Wow, Mystery Babylon, the House of Rothschild, the Judeo-Communist Empire, and Zionist Empire. Well, if the Antichrist is yet in the future, it can't be referring to them, right? That's why they distort Daniel chapter 9, folks, and we'll be getting into that next Friday night, okay?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And then tomorrow night we should be finishing up the Book of Acts. And,
yes, and we'll probably I want to do a recap of some of the important things that we covered in Acts to round out the time. And
yeah, we're very much looking forward to that. And then my guest on Sunday is potentially Barbara Lowe Fisher, the founder of the National Vaccine Information Center. Her group is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, anti-vaccine agitation groups. And it'd be interesting for her to tell her story on my show on Sunday. So, again, thank you for listening, everybody. And we'll see you tomorrow night. And Yahweh bless, everybody.
Take care and Yah bless.
Yah bless.